And good evening. It's Tuesday night, January 13th, 2015. This is The Refinery, the place where grassroots organizations come together to explore the best ways to make conservative messaging work, to reach and influence more people. We're live every Tuesday at 8:30 Central at therefinerieshow.com. You can go there anytime to subscribe to our YouTube channel or podcasts that are available at Vigilant Liberty Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. There's also plenty of options there for you to provide us feedback as well. We would love to hear from you. What do you want us to talk about? What do you think about our show? How can we be better? So please go to therefinerieshow.com and check us out. Tonight we have me, Leslie P., and Ryan Bickmore. We are from the Conservative Union, a Google Plus community. We've got Felicia and JD from the Free Radical Network, and we have Corey and Andy Paith from the Party of Choice. The first thing we have to talk about is not what we were what anybody wanted to talk about, and that is the Islamist terrorist massacres of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, France. As luck would have it, and as timing would have it, that happened. Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, our time. It was Wednesday about 11:30 in Paris, so Wednesday 4:30 a.m. You know, not really all that long after we finished this show, talking and laughing. And there were people going to work at a satire magazine, and they were gunned down by Islamist radicals. And the editor-in-chief, he had been, their office had been bombed before. The editor-in-chief had a bodyguard. He and the bodyguard were both killed. One of the policemen, who I guess was guarding their facility outside, he was also killed. Was a Muslim, by the way. One woman was killed, the rest were men. Apparently the woman who was killed there in their offices was a Jew, and she was killed because she was a Jew. The two guys who did it had researched, they knew exactly where they were going and what they were doing, so it was pretty well planned. And unlike previous Islamist extremist terrorism attacks, these guys didn't commit suicide, they ran away. And it was when they were in the process of running away that they killed the policeman who was on his way to help see what was going on. Anyway, so they ran away. That was on Wednesday. Paris went crazy. And then on Thursday, there was an intentional killing of a Paris policeman. We didn't know whether that was terrorist related or not. Turns out it was. And then the next day, on Friday, the two terrorists were seen, and they ended up taking hostages at a printing company. Paris held the printing company owner operator hostage for many hours, and shortly after that whole hostage situation started, another guy who was part of their radical cell took hostages at a Jewish grocery store, and he had 13 hostages there, four of whom he killed almost immediately in betrayal of his messaging to the police, the French police. He told them, you know, do something, you know, don't break in and I won't kill anybody. And so then he broke his word and he killed four of the hostages. So these guys were, you know, out for blood no matter what. Those hostage situations ended with the three hostage takers dead, the bad guys dead. But as it turns out, there is still one person at large, and that was the girlfriend slash common law wife of the guy who took the hostages in the Jewish grocery. And she is believed to be the woman who was responsible for killing the policewoman, I guess it was, on Thursday. And she, turns out, may have escaped to Syria or Turkey or somewhere at this point. So all of that was going on. I mean, it was a pretty intense 48 hours in Paris, and we learned in the meantime that France is 10% Muslim population, and there are like 18 sectors in all of France that are considered no-go zones where police and infidels are not allowed. Not even electricity and sewer services can go into those no-go zones. Those are absolutely, completely isolated Sharia law enclaves in the middle of the government of Paris, and they've been allowed to happen. And that, of course, is where these Islamist cells spring up, and it's just absolutely insane and ridiculous, and I don't even understand why Paris allowed that to happen. But our press and the press around the world and people around the world proclaimed Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie, proclaiming solidarity with the cartoonists, proclaiming solidarity with the nation of France, with the people of France, against the radicals. And on Sunday, there was a tremendous big rally, the biggest rally of people in France's history ever. There was possibly as many as 1 million people gathering in the streets of Paris, and they say more than 3 million people at different locations throughout France. In Paris, there were more than 40 world leaders gathered from all over Europe and a couple from Africa. We even had both Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas were there, along with the current president of France, the former president of France, Germany, prime minister of England, just quite a few, lots and lots of important people from all over Europe. There was one or more representatives from Russia and some of the satellite republics around there. Wasn't anybody of import from America? That's another story. We'll get to that at some point. So, anyway, I think for me, one of the immediate first things to notice, when any big news story happens, you immediately have a hashtag. That's sort of the way our society works now. We have hashtag world, and Je suis Charlie, kind of a natural hashtag to come out of it, and people were proclaiming their solidarity all over the place. Charlie Hebdo, the massacre happened because they published cartoons that were offensive, that whether or not they were offensive, they represented Muhammad, and that's something that the Islamic radicals do not allow, and that was their excuse for committing this atrocity. And so the cartoons that Charlie Hebdo published were very much a part of the story, very much a part of the story. And it became an editorial question of does such and such news organization, do we publish the cartoons that are at the heart of the story, putting ourselves and our employees at risk? Do we stand with freedom of speech? Do we proclaim that the bullies have not won? Do we publish these cartoons or not? And this event has allowed us to see what of our American and actually worldwide news and news organizations really do stand for freedom of speech and which ones do not. And I don't know, you guys have you seen any surprises in people who were willing to publish the cartoons and gain some respect for organizations that you didn't necessarily respect before?
No, not really. In particular, seeing how the New York Times has responded, it's just been, it's ridiculous how we as a nation have seen so much protecting our First Amendment rights, and how particularly the left is so known for some reason or another. It doesn't, they don't seem like it lately, but known to be out there and protecting those rights, and to be pushing the limits of free speech and making sure that it's known that it's protected. Not so much from the New York Times, not so much from a lot of other liberal publications, and it's annoying. Certainly a lot of conservative news outlets have put out these cartoons. I know CNN also did. I guess that's a surprise, and that was good of them. But
Did they? I didn't. I had CNN
yeah,
on my bad list.
no, they put they put the cartoons out.
They did finally. Well, that's good. That removes them from my bad list consists of the New York Times, NBC, MSNBC, and the Associated Press. And when it's the Associated Press, that means that most newspapers across the country, because that's where they get their content.
Yeah, and the thing about the Associated Press that was really insane to me. I saw Larry O'Connor posted about this, during the week on his Facebook page, that the Associated Press took down their pictures of Piss Christ.
Oh, to retcon that they are respecting, that it's not that they're afraid of Islamists. They're doing it out of respect.
Yes, clearly that's the case.
Yeah, that's been in the culture for how many years, and now all of a sudden, oh, maybe we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, yeah.
What? That's so inconsistent. It's not even funny.
And
it's those outlets repulsive.
Those outlets that said we're not publishing because, you know, while this particular author may be brave, I don't have a right to take that risk for the people I work with. I can at least respect that as being honest. You're doing it because you're scared of the Islamists. You're saying, I'm a chicken.
It's scared of the lawsuits that would ensue from an attack by Islamists. Let's be very clear.
God, that's probably more true. More true. I did want to say the list that I have of those who did publish the cartoons, and this would be the ones who not only published the original cartoons, but also published what came out today, which is the Charlie Hebdo's next issue, their follow-up after with the staff that remains alive. But anyway, the list of the ones that I do have that are the good guys: National Review Online, Fox News, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, New York Post, Weekly Standard, Bloomberg, Huffington Post, Daily Beast, Getty, Vox and BuzzFeed, The Guardian, the BBC, The Times of London, The Financial Times, Spain's El País, which obviously I'm not Spanish, I pronounced that totally wrong, and Germany's Berliner Zeitung. Those also ran the cartoons, and I'm certain there were more in Spain and Germany and elsewhere. This is just what I had the list of. But I was pleasantly surprised to see that Vox and BuzzFeed and the Huffington Post published the cartoons. That's definitely points in their favor. And on the bad side, there was an article by a German, not a German blogger, but a German news writer who said that, you know, he has long had a great deal of respect for the New York Times, considered them America's news source, as so many of us grew up thinking. And this episode, he has lost all respect for them because he's seen them for what they are. And it's big news is shines a bright light on everyone, and you get to see who people really are. And they've shown themselves. So many in our media have shown themselves as cowards. Right. To the extent that they'll show a picture of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons, and they will crop it so that you see everything but the picture of Muhammad. But they won't crop out the picture of, you know, the nasty cartoon caricature of the Jew. They'll leave that, but they'll black out Muhammad. So it's not that they're afraid of being offensive.
No, it's a very particular group that they're afraid of offending.
Doesn't the fact, you know, it's so funny because these liberal papers despise Christians, Mormons, Jews, and so forth. Doesn't the fact that they will so easily post insults and negative cartoons and so forth about all of us, doesn't that simply prove that they believe we are peaceful, we are non-threats, we are good neighbors, we are everything that the Islamists are not?
And yet they'll run the moral equivalent stories, though.
Absolutely.
What do you mean? Like, what kind of stories? Are you talking like ones that say that
Islam isn't so bad. Look, Christianity did all the Crusades.
Look, Jerry Falwell sued, Larry Flint.
Okay. Yeah.
Somehow that's equivalent.
Yeah. Let me ask them this, if I may. Okay. First of all, the Crusades were largely a response to radical Islam, and we are seeing today. I'm not justifying the Crusades, but I am saying we are seeing today that people, even in Europe and everywhere, are seeing the extreme nature of the threat and that it's going to take extreme measures to counter it. But let me ask this, okay? There are extremists in every group of faith or faith, and yet more people are killed in the name of Islam than all other religions combined, by far. So just blaming Islam's extremists makes no sense when everyone else's extremists combined don't cause anything resembling this kind of worldwide slaughter. So put it this way, if extremist Christians were killing at even one-tenth this pace, what would we do? You know, I mean, I get a little
weird. We excommunicate our extremists. Westboro Baptist is not representative of anything, and they are excommunicated and excoriated and defended against anytime they want to show up. And the worst
they even kill people.
The worst they even do is picket funerals.
Let me tell you something, guys. If Christians were killing at even one-tenth the incredible pace that Muslims are, I would, number one, dedicate myself to finding and stopping all of them at all costs. I'd root them out. I wouldn't just say they're bad. I'd root them out. I would dedicate myself to protecting society from them. Number two, I would insist that all immigration, including student visas for Christians, stop until the problem is fixed. I would insist on it. And number three, I would insist that Christians be profiled and watched, you know, in our places of worship, watched more closely. I would insist on these things. And that's what I tell people when they try to say, oh, it's just the extremists, it's the Muslim extremists. I say, you're right. It is just the Muslim extremists. You're right. The other ones aren't killing. I'm with you. I take the wind out of their sails with that. But then I say, how come their extremists are killing more than everybody else's combined? We all have extremists in every faith. How come nobody else's are killing at anywhere near this faith? And how come they're not doing anything about it? How come all I see is a march somewhere in France? Look, why is this all I see? What are you guys going to do about your extremists? What are they going to do about theirs? And why don't you in the media quit trying to equivocate, quit trying to equate us to them?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, it kind of makes sense, because the left treats their extremists much the same way that they treat the Islamic extremists. They don't really call out the Bilairs and the Bernardine Dorn and the, you know, they aren't exactly the harshest critics of their own extremists, and have not tried to...
They rehabilitate their extremists.
Rehabilitate, yes. That's exactly what it is. It's not really shocking to me when it comes to the left. Another way that moral equivalency and all of that ridiculousness comes into play is that they also say that, oh, well, Muslims, these extremists, they kill Muslims more than they kill anybody else. So that's another line that they go with, and it's just absolutely appalling that they think that that's even an excuse.
Are we supposed to be okay with that? Because killing Muslims, who cares?
Yes, because the rest of us on the planet, we are all collateral damage.
But the thing is, I don't want the extremists to kill Muslims either.
Thank you.
I don't want the extremists to kill anyone.
Yes, period. It's not... killing is bad, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Killing is bad. It's bad to kill, okay?
The point I made this week was that if you value your feelings... And you think more than human life, and that you think being offended or causing offense is a capital offense, you don't belong on this planet. And I'm going to do, and I think we ought all to do, everything we can to put you out of civilized society, hunt you down, and remove you from where you can do any more damage.
Well, let me ask this, Fishy. At this point, with what they're seeing around the world, you know, the fact, you know, that they've had immigration go in and the Muslim society, communities are having kids at four times the pace of the other, you know, this growing problem. And you can say, well, it's only the extremists. Yeah, but there's no way to weed them out. You don't know where the extremists are and where the people are who are helping them and so forth. At this pace, at this point, are a lot of people starting to come to the point of understanding the only way to deal with radical Islam is to remove it from the food chain completely?
Well, that gets into all the hows and wherefores, and that's not what we're here to to talk about. But yes, absolutely, people who think that, you know, their feelings are more important than other people's lives, yes, those are people you remove from society, whether they're Islamic, whether they're, you know, a gang member, whether they're a government official, you know, you take them out of circulation.
No, of course, I agree. Anybody who would do that, of course, not just radical Islam. I only mention them because they're the topic.
Well, and here my question is, how do we thread this needle in the world of short attention spans and sound bites and memes? We understand that radical Islam is the quote tiny percentage, but you know, given the numbers, it's about 10% of the Muslim population is the radicals who would in fact take up arms, and then there's another 10 to 20% that would support them, and they're very well funded, and the numbers are enough to be a very significant threat to the world, and they are a threat to Western civilization, and we need to recognize that. How do we, as conservatives out there in the political realm, sharing these stories and trying to convince others to join the conservative movement, how do we express that this is the important battle that we need to be fighting, and that the left seems to want to deny the battle's existence? And we have to tell people what it is, and we have to recognize it as having its roots in the religion of Islam, without it being a religious war seen as conservatives hate Muslims. How do we do that? How do we message it?
That's a really good question. I think part of the issue is we are seeing that our own media is not amplifying the voices that they say are out there in great numbers of people who are moderate, less extreme, whatever you want to say, people who are disgusted by this display in Paris and the things that were carried on in the name of Islam. If our media isn't amplifying those voices, and then they're turning around and saying, well, the American people or the West is just focused on these tragedies and not listening to the voices, why aren't they putting those voices out there?
I see Zudi Jasser on Fox News all the time, but I don't think that he gets on NBC, MSNBC, or CNN. They end up calling the guys from CARE to give the Islamic perspective, rather than people like Zudi Jasser, who talks about political Islam and that it has to be rooted out from the side of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the guy who should be the voice.
How much coverage did Al-Sisi's comments? From Egypt. You know, he's the guy in charge over there.
Go ahead and summarize that if you can.
Well, no, I mean, he basically just came out and said what you just said, that political Islam, that there needs to be a moderation here, that we cannot tolerate this attack on free speech. This cannot stand. Things have to change.
This was on New Year's Day. The president of Egypt said this. And he was saying it very publicly, and he was saying it to the imams in Egypt, that Islam needs to be reformed and that Islam can't be controlled by the radicals. This guy stood there and said it.
Yeah,
we should be proclaiming him to all corners.
And he's lived almost 2 weeks since then. Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That is a sad statement, isn't it?
Those are the things we want moderate Muslims to say. And we want his voice to be amplified. And, my God, nobody's talking about it.
I can't remember where I saw this, but there was an article from, and I'll find it by the time we get the show posted and the links up. I will have found it. But there was an article about a guy saying, I think it was in Reason, perhaps, it was talking about, no, Islam doesn't indeed say that depicting the Prophet is blasphemy. No, indeed, it doesn't command them to kill all unbelievers. Okay, that is one of the problems with dealing with Islam as a whole, is because we don't have consistent information coming out of different, you know, all the different groups. Obviously, Christians are split denominationally, but there are some fundamentals that they agree on. Islam tends to operate the same way. The stakes are just a heck of a lot higher in the disagreements in Islam. And we can't get, there is no definitive answer of what Islam is, because even if indeed 80 or 90% of people practiced it in the way that we understand religion ought to be practiced, that 10% is going to still do the things they're doing, say the things they're saying, and reflect on so many of the other people who don't follow that. And parsing it out and trying to understand, you know, anything such as true Islam is sort of a lost cause. And you also don't want to preemptively be spying on people simply because they belong to a particular religion, or, you know, investigating folks. You want to focus on behavior just the same way you would want us to be under suspicion from NSA based on what we do, not necessarily the fact that we're breathing like they do now. You know, you want some probable cause in there. I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how you square that circle. But with so many different versions of stories coming out about what Islam is and is not, there's no way to trust it for a Westerner anyway, because anybody can say anything about what it does in fact mean or not mean, and we just don't know. We don't, because it's not a consistent thing between people who believe one way and people who believe another. It just so happens that people who believe one particular way are doing all the killing.
Well, and I think in large part it doesn't matter what people believe or what they think. I mean, in our nation of in our nation that is under the rule of law, we don't really need to know what you think or what we believe. We only need to know how you act, because that's the only thing that is of importance in the law. And particularly with the perpetrators of the events in Paris, those individuals were known to French law enforcement, and in fact were known to American law enforcement, because they had been in training in Syria. They had been in prison before for trying to do evil things. They were on the no-fly list. They were, every single one of them, all four of the people that we're talking about, were known to our national security apparatus as well as France's national security apparatus. But they weren't being watched as closely as they could have been or as they should have been, I think in large part because of the national and international denial of Islamic radicals as the source of terror. I mean, I don't know what it is, but when it comes down to it, most of the terrorism that we've seen and that we've had has come from people that have been known to the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, they're people that have been watched. It's not all of a sudden, oh my God, all of a sudden Felicia Cravens went crazy and she's somebody who's never even had a parking ticket. That isn't the way it happens. It's people that we know have been, you know, in training and that kind of thing. And I think if somebody is known to have gone over to Syria for radicalism training, sure, your passport is such and your family lives here and you're an American citizen, sure, you can come back, but we're going to watch you like a hawk.
Remember that she's a member of the Tea Party, a well-known terrorist organization. So
racist, homophobe, sexist, bigoted, white, privileged. Am I forgetting something? Texan. Texas privilege.
Texan.
Yes.
Yeah. Plus, aren't you like related to the founders or something like that? You can trace back your root. You're just such an elitist.
Yes. D-A-R totes.
Terrible.
Wouldn't one of the real problems simply be the numbers? We can say, well, they were known. Problem is, for everyone that is known and then does something, there's 100 who are known and don't. There are such enormous numbers of Muslims.
It's true.
Who are known to have connections, who are known to be possibly dangerous, because it is such an incredibly dangerous and connected religion. And
it's true.
I mean, you know, when I look at, you know, we're talking about, well, how do we message this? What do we tell people to get them to understand the nature of the threat? And when I'm talking to people, I put it real simple. I say, guys, imagine the Nazis, and then imagine infinitely worse. What if the Nazis had the capacity of modern warfare, including chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons? Imagine that. What if the Nazis were threaded throughout many nations? No borders. You couldn't just go to Germany and get them. okay? What if they were everywhere and hiding behind kids in hospitals, okay, to make it look as bad as possible when you took them out? What if the Nazis were highly financed with oil and opium money, okay, with endless financing? What if the Nazis were driven by religious zeal? Think of that. And here's the biggie, guys. What if the Nazis were willing and, in fact, wanted to die fighting you? Think of what kind of enemy would that be? And now tell me this. And I've asked young people this after putting that out. What would it take to defeat them? Can you do it while dotting every I, crossing every T, not enhanced interrogating anybody, not getting your hands bloody and your feet muddy? Can you do it while being a perfect little libertarian? Okay. And by the way, I happen to love the libertarians. And by the way, I don't think I agree with them on a lot. I don't think we can afford to be the world cop. I don't want us to be so isolationist. I don't want us kicking in doors around the world. I'm just saying, before we try to comfort ourselves and blame America first, we need to start understanding the nature of the threat, and then I put it on people and say, now you tell me how to defeat them. I don't want to hear pretty happy answers. I want to hear the reality. How are you going to defeat what I just described?
Think of how difficult it is to get through that process that you just stated, all those things, and come out with too much different from, say, current policies as were operated under the last, you know, over the last 10 years. It's very difficult to get there, to get to the point where you can make all these distinctions and put all these handcuffs around how you take care of this. Chief point that everybody should grasp when dealing with this particular issue, not indicting a whole religion, but understanding that there is an element within it that does not value life, that does not value their own lives over their missions. They are willing to die for the things they believe in, and they are willing to take other people with them. And that requires serious thought and serious discussion, and not platitudes and, you know, hashtags and cards, you know, with little slogans on it. It takes real thought.
Yeah, and by the way, you just added, I gave five, you just added a sixth, Fishy, a really good one. Not all the members of this religion are that way. The majority aren't. That makes them harder to find. Now they're in a sea. These piranhas are in a sea, and we've got to distinguish them from the other, like, fish that look like them in that sea. It's even worse. They're everywhere. They're threaded through everywhere. And we have this ridiculous society. The same society that calls on the cops in Ferguson to show restraint rather than the people who are trying to kill them. We have this same society telling us we've got to thread every needle, be perfect, and blame America the second we do anything that might possibly offend somebody. And I'm telling you, let me just say the message right now, folks. There is no way we can confront this incredibly fast-growing threat without offending, without collateral damage, without taking out innocence. I hate to say that. I don't like that. And there's no way we can do it while honoring everybody's liberty rights to the way that we would like. These people are too dangerous, and they use those liberty rights against
us. Let's understand, too, how we get to this point, how we got right here to where we are, to where the left is not even willing to look at this, in the way that you detailed, in the way that you've outlined as the threat that you've outlined it. They have been denying supremacy of Western civilization for decades. They have been moral equivalenting their way out of Western civilization first. And they've been saying all cultures are equal, multiculturalism, everybody has some, you know, great thing to offer. Well, that might be so, but not all cultures are equal. We have seen it on display in writ large this past week that there are cultures that have better values and there are cultures that have worse values. And that isn't even to touch necessarily the religion the religious part of it, although that is a culture. A culture is just a matter of a number of people large enough to be recognized as such. But Western civilization has been under attack by leftists and institutional left for ages because they don't want to ascribe to those values because, well, any number of reasons, it makes them, they're full of their own white guilt or whatever. They, you know, use the conquest and the imperialist words around different things. Dinesh D'Souza did a pretty good job in one of his books talking about how colonialization and everything turned out pretty good for some people. It might not have been great for the people under at the time, but the fact that Western civilization was pushed down into certain cultures has made them better in the long run. It was extremely painful, and they did a lot of horrible things. But Western civilization, since the body of it, is still a force for good, and the left has been denying this for years, and that is why they don't look at this as a threat the way that we do.
Well, go ahead, Leslie.
Well, I think this gets to where we have an opportunity with the tragedy here, and that sounds very crass for me to even phrase it that way, but we actually have a situation where, because of the gravity of this tragedy, because of the scope of it, there are millions of people paying attention now who have been lulled into apathy for years, who may have actually believed the good news that the war was over and everything was peaceful and the economy's turning around and just make happy and go to the mall. There are a lot of people who have been shaken out of that apathy and complacency. It's not really apathy, it's just complacency. People have been shaken out of that. 3.5 million of them went to a rally. And these are people who they don't engage in politics. They don't like politics because politics is ugly and it's mostly just people hating on each other, which it really is, by the way. We all know that. But these are people who know deep down in their heart and in their gut that something is very wrong and they're very scared and they need to do something right, and that the enemy in their midst that they've been denying was an enemy has proclaimed himself to be their enemy, and he has come after them with big-ass guns and killed a lot of them, and they need to stand up and do something and say, not here, not now, not ever. And that's what those millions of people in France were doing, and all they could do was stand and gather and stand cheek by jowl with one another and say, we are all representatives of Western civilization, and it is a good thing, and it is a better thing than any other civilization that this planet has ever known, and you're not going to stop us. And that's where rallies actually do matter. I've started to see pushback from, I don't know, the pretentious clerisy that says, oh, rallies don't do anything, you know, they just stand there and then they go home. Well, actually, the people who believe that politics is the be-all and the end-all don't really understand that politics is downstream from culture, like Breitbart told us. And rallies are what allow culture to change very rapidly. Remember civil rights rallies? That changed a culture on a dime. Vietnam rallies, Tea Party rallies. That takes something that is quiet and among a tiny minority in a culture and magnifies it and allows for cultural change to happen very rapidly. That's why, and then after the cultural change happens, then you can elect different leaders, and then your politics can change, and then because your politics changed, then you can fight the war to win the battle for civilization. So I think this rally is a hugely important first step in getting the culture to change enough so that we can change our politicians.
Go ahead, Jay.
Well, I was just going to say, and it's kind of a shame that just like with the Green Revolution in Iran, where is America? And by America, I mean the political leaders of America. Where are we? Well, doesn't seem like we're aiding too much. We didn't think it a big deal enough to send any of our high-ranking officials to the rally. We didn't think it a big deal enough to aid the Green Revolution in Iran. So these are examples of just not thinking that that this trend, you know, the any push towards Western civilization, and that is really what we're talking about here, because this is the rally was in support of Charlie Hebdo, and the concept that you shouldn't have to fear getting killed for any kind of speech. You should not fear being killed for expressing your freedom of speech. And that is one of the cornerstones of Western civilization.
Oh yeah. I mean, that rally to me marked the West, including all these socialist nations, okay, all these liberal nations, waking up, and at least for a moment, one single bright shining moment in time, they realized we cannot blame the victim anymore. Okay? You know, and by the way, our president does nothing but blame the victim. He does nothing but, you know, it's America. We cause it by our actions. Boy, if we didn't act the way we did, then, you know, Islam would stay and not do these things. It's ridiculous. You know, these people have gotten to the point where, here's the situation. They're like, it's like having a rapist rape a dozen women, and now he's in prison. And we find one of these women and want to blame her for wearing tight clothing. We feel that she must have provoked it. Are you kidding? These people kill over a cartoon. These people are killing at a pace that far outpaces all the other groups on the planet combined, for any reason combined, and they don't care.
The cartoon, the offensive cartoon, because you're not allowed to depict Muhammad, that was their excuse on that particular occasion. They will use whatever excuse is handy.
Yes.
Not drawing cartoons will not save your life.
Right, and it wasn't like these people marching were saying, okay, let's start kicking in doors, you know, deny all Muslims everywhere their rights. But I think they're taking it seriously, finally, oh my gosh, hidden amongst all these peaceful Muslims are a far too high concentration of non-peaceful Muslims. They're killing far more than anyone. And, you know, sorry, Ron Paul, sorry, Rand Paul, but we're not to blame.
Rand Paul didn't say anything about say anything about that. Ron did. Rand did not.
You're right. That was Ron. Rand has only been, in my opinion, a little too isolationist on this. Nothing like his dad. Not even in the universe of his dad. I stand corrected. But while I do believe, I still believe we need to be more careful, we need to make sure that when we use our military around the world, we show that we are not there to control, but that we are there to bring liberty only, okay? We must make that, we must be the shining light on the hill.
That's easier said than done.
Well, and frankly, I'm not concerned about bringing liberty to other people. Other people don't matter as much to me. I'm there to end the threat. Just like, you know, when you're learning how to use your gun and when you're taking your concealed handgun license class, you're instructed that what you do is you stop the threat. You don't shoot to kill the guy, you shoot to stop the threat. I want to go to war to stop the threat to me. Whatever happens to those countries we're in, that's fine. If we're giving them a space to create freedom for themselves, awesome. We'll probably even hang around, and our companies will invest money in them. Best of luck. But we're primarily there to spend our taxpayers' money and our soldiers' blood and treasure to stop the threat to us. That's what I care about.
But we're defending liberty. You're right. Whether they decide to...
Right, defending liberty, not so much spreading it.
Whether they decide to see that light on the shining on the hill and let that light into them and let that liberty into their country, that's up to them.
I've said it before, there's not a Thomas Jefferson in a lot of the other places in the world. And again, that goes back to civilization, Western civilization. If they have different values and they don't value things the way we do, that's one thing. But in order to create places in which liberty will flourish, they have to do the work themselves. You're right that securing liberty is securing liberty for us and being a place that people can go when there is no liberty for them somewhere else. you know, we've been that place, and other nations have done that as well, you know, welcomed people who've been, you know, kicked out or almost exterminated out of their countries or whatever. But I want to stop for just a second and pause on this. The same week in which 12 people were massacred in Paris, 2,000 or so were killed in Africa. Was it Nigeria? I don't remember. It was Thursday
yes,
night.
Nigeria.
I was watching Foreign Matters from FRN. It was Stefan, who we had on last week, and George Templeton, Rodent Politics. And they brought this story up, and it was something that had just happened on Thursday, or Wednesday or Thursday, one of the two. And those guys went in and explained what happened, talked about who was doing it. And I've seen very little coverage in the media about that. And it was Boko Haram, another Muslim organization, a Muslim terrorist organization here, that has done that.
They were the ones of the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag
yes.
fame, by the way.
Yes. And
have they brought back our girls yet?
The Western media is nearly silent on this. I've seen a couple of stories, but it has been nearly silent on this. So can we also say that the media has been very choosy about who they cover in terms of lives
matter? Weren't those black lives that mattered?
Thank you. Thank you. Do we find that massacres in Africa are less important, even done by the same mindset that perpetuated the Paris massacre? Are they less important because they live in Africa? That's disgusting to me that that's the case, but that's what the media has been doing.
And
it's
Boko Haram.
Cherry picking.
And it's Boko Haram, another radical Islamist organization looking to spread their version of Sharia law everywhere at the point of a gun and at the edge of a machete. And the 2,000 people that were killed were reportedly those who were unable to run away. So it was children, women, and old people that were massacred. And yeah, poor black women, children, and old people.
The most helpless, which is what Western civilization has always tried to be about protecting. You don't see other civilizations that do that.
And Nigeria is one of the most populated nations in Africa, and it is an oil-rich nation, and it's not something that has a lot of attention from us. One of the world leaders that was standing next to President Hollande from France, Hollande, however you pronounce his name, it's French, I don't know, was the president of Mali, and people are like, well, we arrogant Americans are like, Mali, where's that? Who cares? What's that going on? Why is that guy there? Well, Mali is a nation in Africa that's been fighting a very desperate war against the Islamic radicals, and France has been doing a great deal to help them. I think maybe Mali is a former French protectorate or part of the French Empire or something, but France still feels very deeply an obligation to that nation and has been helping them quite a bit with money and soldiers and overflights and stuff like that, I think. So the battle is raging in Africa, all across the northern piece of Africa, Egypt west. And we have Egypt with President al-Sisi, who spoke some sense, and then we have Tunisia on the far western edge that has spoken some sense, and it's all the guys in the middle. Which includes Libya, the basket case, that is currently Islamic hotbeds, along with the Middle East. I mean, there's a huge, huge amount of territory that the different groups of Islamic radicals are trying to form their caliphates, and Boko Haram is taking over an awful lot of land and killing a lot of people to form their caliphate, and ISIS, or I guess I'm calling them now Daesh or whatever it is. It's the name that they hate to be called by. So,
Daesh.
Daesh, something like that. Daesh. They're trying to form their caliphate in Syria and northern Iraq. And then we have Al-Qaeda trying to form their caliphate from the base in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. And eventually they'll each have their own mid-sized caliphates, and then they'll decide, oh, you know what, Sunni, Shia, hey, let's work together and kill all of this Western civilization and form one big caliphate, and they will. And that's the way it'll all work. We can't, I don't know if a strategy of playing them off against each other works. And, you know, those are well above our pay grade. But the threat is, as Andy says, the threat is everywhere. And there are representatives of Boko Haram and ISIS and Al-Qaeda well-trained in America. We don't know where. The risk is everywhere. But we have to recognize it. And I'm thinking that now we're closer than we've ever been before to being able to acknowledge and recognize that the threat, in fact, has at its root the religion of Islam. That's what they're using as their inspiration. They say it's their motivator. Who am I to question what they say?
There's a whole heck of a lot of that, second guessing. Well, one of the things that we did want to get to is this week is left tactics and sort of do our left tactics segment on the Dodge. And it plays really well into the whole issue with the Charlie Hebdo massacre because of all the discussion we've just had. The liberal Dodge, the left Dodge that says, that takes a position and then until that position is not convenient anymore. And to talk about this, we've got the third chapter of Kurt Schlichter's I Am a Liberal, and I'm going to put that link in the chat. It's I Am a Liberal, a conservative's guide to dealing with nature's most irritating mistake. And it's beautiful that Kurt named it that. I love that that is the title. But the chapter three, JD and I have sort of become acolytes of Schlichter's chapter three. We tell everybody about it all the time. And here's the reason why. Some of the insights in this are so fundamental to being effective as conservatives that we thought it deserved its own little discussion. And I am sure that Andy will recognize a heck of a lot of the things that we're going to talk about. Let me just start by outlining it a little bit with some quotes that Kurt has, and this is, just soak this up as I read this to you. Liberal principles simply do not exist. Liberalism is merely a collection of political poses supporting the growth and expansion of liberalism itself. That's really powerful because we can see evidence of that, and we'll go into some examples in a minute. But so the idea is, we know that liberalism believes in nothing more except liberalism, but many voters still imagine that liberals are the defenders of women, of civil liberties, of minorities. They have just heard it so often and for so long, they assume it's true. But what our job is to do is to show that that isn't true, to poke holes in that, and to let them reveal, as Andy Osman says, the elements of control and the bullying that goes on that leftism is really about. The minute that you put these liberal principles, I did air quotes, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. The minute you put these liberal principles to the test, they vanish. Kurtz reads, it says, those longstanding moral positions that liberals have so valiantly defended, gone with the wind the second they stop being useful. Can anybody say, you must always believe women about rape? Wasn't that a line that we were hearing not too long ago when we were talking about University of Virginia? Except yes. That if the perpetrator happened to be Bill Clinton, then you don't use that line, do you, if you're on the left? That principle gets thrown out. That woman gets thrown out. If she happens to be riding in a car with a Kennedy, that principle gets thrown out.
Well, okay, so if the bad guy is like Bill Cosby, then all the women claiming rape are perfectly believable. If the perpetrator is a well-known Republican at Oberlin College named Barry, then we absolutely believe Lena Dunham. If the perpetrator is Bill Clinton, then Paula Jones is a lying skank.
See how that works?
Okay.
That is exactly illustrative of what liberalism is at its core. Let's talk about speech. Okay, we've just spent all this time on Charlie Hebdo. That
free speech is absolutely important. It's super, super important. Yeah, free speech. We got to be able to say whatever we want, and don't be telling me what I can't say.
About Sarah Palin's retard baby. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you conservatives are all dictatorial. You're trying to churchify me and tell me what I can't say.
And then when you get to campuses where certain conservatives have been invited to speak.
Oh, no, that's offensive.
We can't have that.
Ann Coulter would offend people.
It's a microaggression.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous. This, you know, it's not even a double standard. It's just like this ridiculous multi-level thing that whatever, it's amorphous. It's an amoeba defense for the left. They will say whatever they need to get their point across, to advance liberalism. And that's a huge thing. And people don't really realize that, especially when you're talking about the average sort of conservative guy, you know, on Facebook or Twitter and engaging in a discussion and all over, you know, somebody's jumping all over the place, putting out these outrageous claims. What are you supposed to do? These are not good faith discussions that you're having.
And that's very key.
That's true. It's not good faith discussions.
It's very key, because if they are indeed not good faith discussions, then you don't have to treat the things that they say with that kind of respect that you would a person who's actually having an intelligent conversation with you. We have people that we know in our lives who have been left-washed. I use that term every week for a reason. I want people to understand that that's different from...
Oh, holy crap. I'm sorry. I need to interrupt you, Fishy, because Kurt Schlichter is in the chat room.
What? Get out.
Yeah, he is. So.
Hi. Okay. So now that's embarrassing. No, but we know people who have been left-washed and who have been fed these lines, and they're able to parrot them back, but they're not necessarily people who have any kind of intellectual thought behind it. They've just heard these things, they believe them to be true, and they parrot them back. Those are the people that we want to be able to come at with some facts and figures, things like that, in a reasoned discussion. Kurt's not talking about those people when he's talking about going after the left. He's talking about the people who are absolutely committed to this flip-flopping, this, he calls it trying to grasp eels in the book. It's that difficult to pin these people down. And his advice is, go for the hypocrisy. Well, we've been illustrating for the past 5 minutes that hypocrisy. Whether it's on rape, whether it's on race, whether it's on speech, all of these things that the left claims that they value, the institutional left will set the tone. And once they get started and on a particular trajectory and that doesn't work for them anymore, if, oh no, somebody on the left has done something horrible that they've accused somebody on the right of doing, pop, that value is in the trash. And that we need to understand so deeply, because it changes the way we think about talking to other people.
Well, the reason...
Go ahead.
What we're basically saying is the left is a moving target. And the reason they're a moving target is because the one goal, the one reason, the one motivating factor behind being a liberal is control. You only become a liberal to control other people, to make them act as you would hope they would act. And truth is an impediment to you controlling. All right? Truth cannot be controlled. 2 + 2 is going to equal 4. That is something you don't control. It controls itself. And the more truths there are, the more they hem you in, the more they board you in, and you must obey them. You always have to obey truth. You can't disobey truth. You can't break it. You can only break yourself against it. And so the left will always change what they're saying and keep themselves as a moving target so that they're not going to commit to truth, so that they will not be controlled, and that way they can control. For instance, racism. You know, the left, what did they used to hate? They used to hate black people, if you go before the 60s, and the left was heavily against them. Now you know, it's popular within the left to hate white people. Whatever. The big thing is they couldn't care less. All they want is control, and they're going to go with what is convenient at the time and what helps advance that agenda.
Well, and is it since their arguments are always circular and, well, actually not circular, that implies there's some sort of directionality to it. Their arguments just go round and round to wherever they want them to go. Does that mean that's their tactic for never losing? Because if they're never actually making a coherent argument, they can never be defeated because they just shift the ground. So well, is that how they always win? Goal.
That's certainly their goal. And
because they do always win.
Kurt's saying, and I think he would agree with me, that you go after their hypocrisy and you stay focused on the things that you want to ask, and you ignore the side trips that they try to take with different questions. You nail down the sorts of things that they'd want to dodge on, and you don't let them get the advantage there. And the purpose, ultimately, we've talked about this before, the purpose is not to convert the liberal. We will say it every
exactly.
week if we have to. The purpose is never to convert the liberal. You cannot argue him out of his illogic. It's not going to happen. What you're doing is you're, as he says in Chapter 3, you are either rallying the troops and giving them some morale, a morale boost, or you are exposing them for the audience. You are letting them expose themselves by when you poke their hypocrisy, they lose their ever-loving minds and they begin to demonstrate the bad behavior that you know that they have, but they try to keep under wraps. And when they do that, game over. You've demonstrated that they're control freaks. You've demonstrated that they're racists. You've demonstrated that they're willing to use homosexual slurs against people because they slip, you know, quote unquote, slip, and they really reveal what they think. So the point is morale boosting and showing the other people watching, the bystanders, the spectators, what the true value of their argument is and how they are inconsistent and hypocritical. Sorry. That's the whole goal of doing any kind of arguing on the internet or anywhere else in political life.
Exactly. It's for the lurkers that you're really making sure that your arguments are sane and calm and rational, that you're the calm one and that they're being sputtering idiots. It's fun to do.
I'm unhinged.
It's fun to get them there. It's so much fun.
I jumped on a gun control post last, week or so ago. We were talking and they would talk about taking away guns. I'm like, why do you want to take away my right to defend myself or my wife's right? What if I'm at work, I'm not home, it's a big guy breaks in, there's nothing anyone can do about it? And then they would deflect and be like, why are you not answering my question? I asked you a very specific question, you changed your tactic. So then they went back in, changed it again, I pointed out again. After two or three times, they finally said, okay, fine, here's the answer to your question. And they answered and said, it's your home, you can do whatever you want. I'm like, okay, that's great. I can protect myself at home. Now what if I'm out at the fair or something? Why can't I protect myself there? And just we went on and on in the discussion. I kept bringing up all the things.
A troll.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I kept bringing
so
up
funny.
The things that Andy points out, though, like, why are you deflecting? Why are you changing the topic? Why do you want to take away my right to defend myself? I kept pointing out studies of successful people stopping an attack with a concealed carry gun, it's been good in so many cases and it's helped save so many lives. And then they come back with threats. They say, well, I posted a link, I posted proof, I posted news stories, and you didn't post anything. What's going on? And this went on for 50 or 60 or 70 comments, and they just kept trying to change it. They didn't do anything. Anyone that comes along on this post can clearly see what side is rational and calm and posting links and evidence, and what side is just attacking, deflecting, changing the topic.
Absolutely. And the thing is that this is something that we really need to have more of in our movement. We have a lot of people who think that they're capable advocates by calling liberals names, and that's not how you do it.
What is one of our principles here on this show? You are not Kurt Schlichter. Leslie even
Absolutely.
Wrote a piece about that. I'm going to do get up and put that in chat for everybody. You are right.
Not Kurt Schlichter. Only Kurt Schlichter is Kurt Schlichter.
Not everybody has the tools to effectively, you know, use those advanced tactics.
That is not to say you cannot learn them, but do not assume that because you have not studied that you can launch into that and be as effective as Kurt Schlichter.
Right.
But if you're married like me, you can force your wife to refer to you as Kurt Schlichter.
And Cora's not here to defend herself. She would have slapped you. I know she would have.
Oh, my goodness.
It's added a lot to the marriage. It was really kind of grinding down.
What I'm trying to say is that calling people names is generally, and Kurt talks about this in the chapter, it's better when they're calling you names because that makes them look unhinged. They are not the adult in the room. When they start calling you names, and they will, absolutely they will, because their message is so shallow, it doesn't go anywhere. And if you are capable of keeping them on track, on topic, and reminding everyone that this guy is moving away from what they were initially talking about, when you bring facts, when you do what, when you keep your message, and that's another point that's in the in this chapter of I'm a Liberal, is that you have to have your own message and don't be afraid to push your message, because they're going to ignore everything that you say. Be sure that you get your message out there, because this is not an even playing field. This is not something where you have a debate moderator and a set amount of time to make your points and then go on back and forth. That's not what this is. It's an internet conversation or whatever. You need to make sure that you keep on your topics and what you want to say, and that does keep the audience, the people who are watching, it keeps their attention and keeps them focused, because otherwise they're going to go down this rabbit hole that the leftist is talking about, and it spreads misinformation.
Well, and I think it all kind of cycles back to a couple of words that Kurt just said on the chat here, be the strong horse, and that phrase can work for so many things that we're talking about. If you believe that you are right, and we are, you have that quiet confidence, and you are the strong horse. You don't need to be the bully. You don't need to name call. You don't need to be petulant or ridiculous or toss out stupid memes. You just have the facts with you, and you have the good stories, and you have the good heart and the soul, and you are the strong horse, and people will follow you. And the strong horse concept is something that then also ties back to foreign relations, like we were talking earlier. And particularly with Eastern culture, they are very much of a shame culture, and they follow the strong horse. Where we've fallen apart as America and as Western civilization is that we've lost our quiet confidence, we've lost our belief in ourselves, and we've lost our presence as that strong horse that everybody else wants to follow. If you just have that quiet confidence and you are the strong horse, people will want to follow you. That's leadership. And you don't insist upon being a leader, you just are one. And you tell people to follow you. You don't push them ahead. You say, I'm going this way, come with me, follow me. That's leadership. And we have to just be conservative in our lives and be confident and conservative in the way we live and the way we interact with people. And that doesn't mean calling people. That means not calling people libtards or leftards or any kind of tard, and making up stupid names for people. Although I will call President Obama, I will call him Barry, because I hope he doesn't like it. And I will call ISIS, ISIS. I will start calling them Daesh if I can ever figure out how to pronounce that, because I read today that they hate it. And so I'm going to call them what offends them, and I'm not going to give them the benefit of calling them an Islamic state, because they are not a state. So I will be petulant and juvenile sometimes, because why not? But it is like Kurt said, it's be the strong horse, and that really applies in so many areas. It was brilliant, of course, because, you know, Kurt said it.
Well, that's a great transition. That is another great transition. Oh, go ahead, Andy.
Really quick, just this is why, because we can't all be, you know, lawyers and pick people, and it's really hard to corner a leftist because they have no, there's no center, okay, because they have no reason. They'll wander everywhere. They're a moving target, and it can take a long time to corner them. That's why I do try to get people to basically say, focus them with this. I want to control my own life, not yours. Can you say the same? I want to control my own life, not yours. Can you say the same? Now, let's apply that throughout this issue. Go ahead and talk. But I'm going to keep bringing it back to that. And that way, I have a focus, a conservative focus, that I can hold them to and make them sweat.
Very well done. I love that, too. It's so easy. I'm telling you, I was on a two-hour interview show just a couple of days ago, and I barely had to look at my notes because I had been Andy-washed so much from the Party of Choice and all the things that the way that you phrase. I think JD counted the number of times I said choice versus control and stuff like that and name-dropped you guys. People need to be paying a lot of attention to those sort of things and try those methods out because they work. And it's also eliminating the need for all those talking points, as you've said so often. And that brings me to salesmanship, because we were talking about arguing with liberals and the kind of tactics that Kurt recommends for doing so and keeping those principles in mind that they are indeed without center on the left and expediency is everything for them. What on the right that we have, I think, to get people to understand is there's a difference between selling and selling out. And so I wrote a piece about that. It is at freeradicalnetwork.com. And here's sort of what I started with. I was on a radio program. I was asked to go on the morning news in Houston, very big market. It was the news program. I was asked to speak because a state senator, Republican, had complained that a Hispanic person testifying in front of his committee spoke in Spanish with a translator present, and the guy had been in the country for 19 years. And he made a big deal out of this. And so the media called me, and they wanted to have me be on their morning program up against a state representative. Now, here I am, just a Tea Party leader of one group, and up against a state representative who was also a Latina woman. So the setup was in. I knew what they wanted. I knew what they were gonna try to get out of me, and I didn't give it to them. So when they talked about this, my first thought was, I've spent since I was 4 years old attempting to learn Spanish. You would never catch me speaking officially in Spanish in a testify situation. Well, that took the wind out of those sails. They went back to the representative. They asked her. She talked about, it was a political matter, and this was just being made for political points. I happened to agree with that. And then they came to me and they asked me another question about it. Whether the Tea Party had a position on this. Okay, so am I just an outlier and the Tea Party really has a position? And I just basically said this is a complex issue. And in this talking point, soundbite culture, people want to make simplistic some very important complex issues. And we encourage people to be thoughtful. They didn't get what they wanted. It was a non-story. But the first thing that happened to me after I did it is I got accused of being sold out to La Raza, because the higher value there wasn't, to me, supporting this Republican state senator who made these comments and screaming English, you know, learn English, get rid of all these illegals who are crapping up our country. That's where someone in the Tea Party wanted me to go with that. And I got accused of selling out over that. And I will tell you, that person still, 4 years later, attacks me on Facebook on a pretty regular basis because of that, in just general threads. My point was that the words that you use and the things that you say, if they're not necessarily the reddest of red meat, there's still a place and a time to use red meat, obviously. But when we're talking to people, of different types, whether it's a women's group or a minority group or an age difference group, a younger group or an older group, you're going to use different languages, different words, choices with them, explain concepts in a different way based on where they're coming from. As a Tea Party leader, I never wanted politicians to come and speak at me. I wanted them to know that, or I wanted to know that they heard me and that they were able to understand what I was saying. It's the same thing anywhere in politics. If you're going in front of a group, if you're talking to a particular constituency, they want to know that you hear them. And so we might use terms a little differently with one group and another, and we might moderate the words. That's not moderating the principles. That's not saying that we're not talking about certain issues or that we're throwing them off completely off the platform, that we should shut up about social issues or anything. Nobody thinks that. But it's that you need to focus on understanding the group that you're speaking to and understand that what sounds really good to the red meat crowd on the right is probably not going to be as persuasive to those people who've been left washed and that need a different sort of connection point with you. And so that was my whole point is when we're talking to different people and we use different words or we use different terms or we phrase things a different way, it's not selling out. I'm tired of people calling it selling out. It's learning the marketing strategies. We talked about this before. Leslie was talking about different ads running on different channels and how they're going to be different. You don't market to ESPN the way you do to Lifetime. And that we need to be more understanding in the right when our leaders do that and not simply, I guess, scream at them when they're not going to places that don't respond to red meat and saying red meat things. So hopefully that sort of penetrates with people. That we have sales to do. It's not just about saying what you want to say. It's about selling to other people.
Absolutely. We are in the liberty and freedom and conservatism selling business. That's our job as activists and as people who, you know, want to have more limited government, who want to change the way things are. It is up to us to go to these places, to go to these people and package what we have to say in a way that they get in their language. And that's on us. It's not devaluing our message. It's not muddying it. It's just going and bringing our message in the most relevant language to the people who we're talking to. And that's important. That's marketing 101, really. I mean, that's what we need to do. It's not somehow unprincipled to talk to young people about the stuff that they care about in conservative context. It's absolutely not selling out when Rand Paul talks about there's no reason for you to be invading my space on my cell phone. There's no reason for you to be checking out my metadata. Talking about that stuff is not selling out. That is, that's going to a important constituency and making inroads. It's talking about any number of these issues. Making sure that we talk about making it easier to build a business, to own a business in areas that are way overregulated, that the kind of obstructions to owning a business in inner cities, say, are so onerous that people can't start their businesses. They can't do what they want to do, whether it's through restrictions because hair braiding, you need a permit to braid people's hair or any number of different things. Talking about issues that are important to a constituency and fall into conservatism, that is not watering down your message. That is making your message more effective. It's being a better messenger, and it's doing more for the cause.
Well, and what's the alternative? I mean, what is the alternative to leave to simply leave these various demographics like young people as unreachable? I mean, what's the game plan there? Is the game plan to keep preaching to them as if they're the choir and thereby talk ourselves into smaller concentric circles? I thought we had to look. I can be a small concentric circle when I want to make my own choices in life. I don't need voters to agree with me when I go get a value meal at McDonald's. I get the one I want. I need voters to agree with me when I'm going to win elections. That means I have to go to them. I don't get it. I don't understand how some people see that as wrong.
It's my principles. You're talking to people who I don't like. I don't like how they have their rap music and their, you know, enjoying Beyonce and horrible movies by Judd Apatow. I don't like that. I don't approve. Therefore, I don't want to deal with them in my party. I don't know. It doesn't really make very much sense to me either. But it's not selling out. The idea that making sure that you are being effective with your messaging is selling out is preposterous. I mean, when you're talking about anything, when you're trying to be persuasive about anything, you talk in the language that your audience speaks. That's what you have to do if you're going to get anything done.
So hopefully people think about that a little more before, you know, I guess charging off to, condemn folks that are actually going out to communities that they haven't been to or constituencies we haven't traditionally tried for. Math is going to catch up with us. We have to make more of us. And it's not even making more converting people. It's reminding them, as we said last week, reminding them or showing them that they already do agree with us.
Absolutely. And I think that transitions pretty well into talking about Andy's piece, because he has, surprisingly, Andy has a new piece out today on thepartyofchoice.com.
Yes, I got it out before the show, yes.
Thank you, finally, because we can put links places. It's so much easier.
JD doesn't hate me for a week. This one I didn't put a lot of humor in. This one I really wanted to just equip people. And it's talking about free college. Now, I get pretty denigrating and mean in this article, and the reason is this. I think the concept of free college is so preposterous and idiotic, it actually redefines those words into a worse place. It is just so stupid. And it's hard for me. Haven't you ever had issues where it's hard for you even to talk about them because you're just like, how can anybody possibly advocate this? And it's hard to even reach out to them in that. So coming from there, here's how I do it. I've actually talked to young people about this, and I've used the talking points that I outline in the article, and folks, they work. They really do. I've gone through these talking points with some young people, and they're just like, oh, you're right. I don't want that. I don't want free college. Absolutely not. So basically, I start like this. I just say, free college, I would never do that to you. They're like, what? I go, look, right now, let me ask you this. Why do you get a high school? And JD, go ahead and unclick your mic. I want to use you as the young person.
Oh, boy, here we go.
Okay. JD, right now, why do you get a high school degree? Why do you get one?
To get a better job, because we can go to college and you need to have that college or that high school degree to get into college.
Exactly. It's the starting line for either getting a job or pursuing further education, right? Okay, next question. Why is it the starting line? Why isn't the starting line sixth grade or a master's degree? Why is it a high school degree? Why is that the leap-off point that you must – why is that the minimum you got to hit?
Because somebody somewhere determined that the skills – the information that you learn in high school is the baseline for higher learning.
Okay, fantastic. Now, JD knows the answer, but he gave the answer that a young person would give, and that's perfect. You can read them their answers for them. They'll understand. I just say, look, it's because it's free. Education is free through 12th grade. Whatever is free, everyone has or can have. Whatever everyone has, you need as a minimum to get started. Right? Okay, so the next question. So why get a college degree, JD?
Because I want to make more money, and because there are societal pressures on me to go to college, because if I don't go to college, then I am a failure.
Yeah. Okay, which isn't true, by the way. But you do it to get an advantage, to get skills and credentials that go beyond what is free, right? Okay, so so if we make 2 years of community college free, now where's the starting line? Is it still at 12th grade? No, it isn't, right? By the way, it takes 13 years to go through that, right? K through 12. Now it's at 15 years. So let's add it all up. So you have to, so if we get free education, if we make two years of college education free, now you have to endure two more years of education just to reach the starting line. And even then, you'll have no advantage whatsoever because everybody has it. So let's do the math. Two more years plus no advantage equals 2 years of your life lost. But it gets worse. You see, increasing everyone's sentence by 2 years costs billions of dollars. And this must be taxed out of the free market. You know, that free market that's actually going to give you a job. All right? So let's do the math again. Now you're adding two more years before you can even get to the starting line and start your life. Plus, you have no advantage, and there are fewer jobs. But it gets worse. The free market can't afford all these higher taxes, so we'll have to add billions of dollars to the national debt, which will also be paid off by, guess who? You, young people. So now, if we add 2 years of free education, it's two more years, no advantage, fewer jobs, and more national debt that has to be paid by younger people who have fewer jobs. See, and here's what I finally tell them. Don't go to a politician who wants to make you wait two more years to start your life. All he's doing is turning it into a non-advantage. The reason that you have to have a high school degree as your starting point is because that's what's free. Whatever is free, that establishes the starting point. What if we made 40 years of education free? That would make that the starting point. You wouldn't be able to start your life until then. Not for real.
Well, I mean, 40 is I've heard that that's where they want to make it so that you get off of your parents' health care insurance. So
when I tell young people this, I say, look, do you really want to push life back two more years? Do you now want to make it take 15 years before you can do anything that gives you any advantage in the workplace while you're sucking billions of dollars out of the workplace that would employ you? Do you want to do that? Do you enjoy school that much that you want to wait that long? I mean, weren't you really happy on that day that you graduated high school and skipped out of those and ran out the door? Let's push it back 2 years, because that's all this does. Do you want that? And then they don't.
I mean, it's a good argument, and I agree with it, and I think that I have to come back and say that I kind of messed up when I intro'd the segment, because this is actually a new segment that we've been trying to put together, or this might be the second installment of this segment of What Do You Say, which is, you know, basically where we want to try and come together on the refinery, talk about an issue, and get that issue, get a message for that issue out there, so that our audience has that kind of arrow in their quiver to talk about this thing on a level that that they can be successful with, and that they can discuss this and feel like they have some good level ground to start with. And I do agree with that tactic. I think that's a good way to approach it, because people are, certainly young people, don't want to be put into that holding pattern for even more time and for something that is ultimately not going to be worth anything. That kind of having this kind of deflation of the college degree and its worth is huge.
Well, the part that you see, an argument that some people would want to use is, well, you know, anytime you subsidize something, you're going to, you know, the price for it is going to rise rapidly. That's very true, and young people won't respond to that. Okay, they won't get that, because at that point you're talking higher economics. You know, this is going to cause that, it's going to cause this. They don't get that. And that's unfortunate. I wish they did.
Except for the free education that they got is right. it's not helping them when it comes to economics. So yes.
Yeah, and I look at them and I say, look, you know, bottom line, what is free establishes the starting point. The reason you have to get a high school degree to get to go anywhere in society is because that's free, which means everybody can or does have it. If you make 15 years of school free, that means you got to go that long to start. Do you want to wait that much? By the way, these are your prime productive years when you can get in and really jump in on that ladder. Maybe try a job or two and find out which ones you don't like and jump around a little bit, experiment, or fly into one and love it and move up. This is the time you want to do that. Now, how about if we went the other way? What if we strip down education to only teach that which you need to succeed in the economy? No more social engineering, no more you listening to what this teacher thinks about the environment or, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But what if we just had school teach you math, science, English, and so forth, what you needed basically? You can still get the other stuff, but it's totally elective. It's totally your choice. And if you could get out of school 2 years even earlier. What is now, it wouldn't even take 15, it wouldn't take 13 years. You could get out in 11 years. Think about that. How would you like to be able to, if you wish, start your life after 11 years with a real degree and get out there, maybe go on to college, maybe go into the workplace, maybe take a year off and hit the beach, whatever. How would you like to be able to do that and choose, or if you want, do some more electives, do some music, do some shop class or something like that. You see, right now we load you down with a lot of classes that don't do much. And let me say something very harsh. I'm not against college degrees. I have one, okay? But I'm going to be honest. As somebody who was in management for a quarter century, I wouldn't want to hire somebody with a college degree if I can have somebody comparable without one, because they're not paying off student loans. And college degrees, I got to be honest, by and large, people who get them are not any better in the workplace. If anything, they're worse. They're more demanding. They're more rooted in what they expect. That's not always true. Some are wonderful, okay? I just haven't seen it. They don't do that much to even prepare you. I hate to say that. I guess that's an indictment of colleges today. There are some who come out of colleges and they're wonderfully prepared, okay? But I just think that it's ridiculous that we have people putting their lives off so long. In earlier times in our country's history, boy, man, you were 16, you were already producing. Okay?
It's become a status symbol.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. 16 is way too young to be working at anything. That's child labor that you're getting into. It's just, you guys are really scary capitalists that you want to have 11-year-olds out there working in sweatshops. That's what it's all about, clearly. Right.
Well, so that we're hoping to do something like this every week when we get a chance to, and sometimes we may miss. But to put together this segment, what do you say? Because there's always going to be talking points from the left that sort of have established a narrative. And we need to be prepared not just to defend our principles, but to go head-to-head with the left, as we were talking about in Kurt's book in that segment. But being able to answer those things, being able to connect with an audience, a particular audience, and this is what Andy did in particular way, taking this particular college, free community college argument that the president's putting out there, that whole narrative that's supposed to make the left look really great, and he picks it apart in a way that resonates with a younger audience. So he's minding his audience, he's selling an idea, he's challenging the left, and he's going head-to-head and not allowing them to be distracting people with that narrative. So Andy's accomplished so much with this one piece. What we're hoping to do every week is be able to talk about a different issue and do that, to give us good answers, practical answers, so that we don't have to recognize those talking points, but we can walk through the process of defending conservatism, and not just defending it, but advancing it. So hopefully that was helpful to some people. Go read that article. It's really got some good points in it and a good way to talk about it that doesn't get lost in the all the minutiae and the details of, and the advanced economic theory. It's plain talk that everyone can understand. And I think that's actually going to wrap us up here. We've gone a little bit over. Sorry about that. But we were sort of a jazz that we had Colonel Schlichter in the chat room tonight. That was unexpected. We've been trying to get him on the show, and he said, no, I'm not going to interrupt an interesting conversation. So thank you for him to come and join us and listen in for
a bit.
Tweet
out the show.
Yes, awesome. And to tweet the show. That was very generous. And, of course, thanks to the regulars that we always have. Thank you, Titan. Thank you, Peru. You guys, PD. You guys, T was in the chat room tonight. Oh, just thank you all who were there. We had Scott join us. We had some other people that we hadn't met before. Welcome, folks. We are always glad to get your participation in chat. And just so you know, we have podcasts available. We have videos that are going to come out this week, little snips of the show that you can share. So you can go to VigilantLibertyRadio.us. On Thursdays, the podcast drops. You can hear it in podcast form. You can get it in other forms at TheRefineryShow.com. That's where we have ours from Stitcher and iTunes as well. Every day, just about, JD and I put out a video on the Conservative Union YouTube channel, where we take those little snippets of the show and just get one idea isolated, and you can think about it, talk about it. We've had a really good week. Thank you, everyone, for commenting, sharing, liking, and viewing our videos. It was a phenomenal week for us. I think that was our best week ever. Is that right, JD?
That is correct. We had 4 videos over 100 views, and we had 2 videos that had over 300 views each. Which was really impressive. So it was a really good week for us as far as the clips go. So thanks to everybody.
So
who's
have you checked the income? Have we made it over a dime yet? I haven't looked.
Yes, we made it 50 cent. We're
what?
Good. 57 cents we're up to.
Oh my gosh, 57 cents.
We can actually like afford to get some bubble gum. I mean, it would be kind of hard to split it, but We could get a thing of bubble gum. We could get probably two pieces of bubble gum.
A 5-pack, maybe. We can each have one piece.
So, okay, I would like to thank all of our viewers because you know what you mean to me?
Yes!
Oh my.
We want to thank everybody. It has been so great to get the support from everyone. We had a busy night in chat. We had a busy week on videos. Share the love. If you find what we're doing valuable, if you think that this is helpful and that you are enjoying this, that you're entertained and informed, not just about this, the outrage of the day, but what to do about it, what to say about it, how we can talk about it better, please continue to share the video, tweet it out, share the links to the show, check out the archives, the other shows that we have, listen to the podcast, and give us feedback. We always want your feedback.
Absolutely. So I will, as the controller boss lady of the technology that is flaky, oh my God, I'm so sorry. It's been kind of a week on that. As always. Anyway, thank you guys, and we will see you all next week. Any final words from anyone? Okay, thanks, and goodbye.